Notice a different background instead of the cabinet behind me. It's because I'm at Dharma Friendship Foundation in Seattle right now teaching. I'd be happy. And I thought, just before we begin, to let people know that there's a variety of people around the world actually listening to the teaching so that we feel connected to each other. So there's the group here in Seattle. There's a group in Boise, the people at the Abbey, of course. And in Spokane, there's a group in Coeur d'Alene. In Jalapa, Mexico, in Torreon, Mexico. And then there's various individuals in, all around the country, and I think some other people in Mexico too. And I probably missed some, much to my chagrin, but I thought you might like to know who else is. Is listening or watching in on the teachings. So let's just take a moment and cultivate our meditation when we actually begin. Yeah. And really feel the joy at having the precious human life. Feel the joy at having the precious human life. And especially rejoice at our interest in the darkness. And appreciate the possibility of attaining enlightenment, both because we have the Buddha nature and because we've met the cooperative conditions, the Mahayana teachings, teachers, and have all the possibility to practice. And let's make a strong determination to use this opportunity wisely. And tonight, specifically, to listen to the teachings, to contemplate them, so we can meditate on them. And we want to do this for the benefit of all living beings, by attaining enlightenment ourselves, so we'll have the wisdom, compassion, and skillful means to lead them to enlightenment as well. So, we've been talking about the six fire routine practices that a bodhisattva does, motivated by bodhicitta, for the purpose of attaining enlightenment. And we've talked about generosity, ethical conduct, patience, joyous effort, and now we are on meditative stabilization. Okay? So last week, we talked about the various hindrances. I was saying that there were two sets of hindrances, one that is spoken of predominantly in the Pali tradition, that is also mentioned in the Bodhisattva Vows, and then the other one that is spoken of predominantly in Maitreya and the Sangha's texts. But I don't think I went through the conditions for attaining meditative stabilization. So I think I better do that before I get into the next set of hindrances.
I don't want to burden you with too.
So, and I think it's important to notice that the conditions that we want to have around us if we really intend to develop shamatha or serenity, which is also translated as quiescence or tranquility or calm abiding. I'm using the word serenity. Because lots of times we come into Buddhism and we say, oh, I'm going to gain samadhi right away. I'm going to meditate a little bit in the morning, and then I'm going to go jogging, I'm going to go to work, I'm going to go to my hobbies and my social life, and come back and do another 15-minute meditation in the evening, and I'll have samadhi and my time flat. Well, maybe if you have exceptional karma, but as for the rest of us, the great masters talked about certain conditions, external and internal conditions, that are important if we intend to be able to develop very deep concentration. And so knowing these helps us to set up as much as these conditions as we can. And also, knowing these helps us to realize that if we don't have all these conditions, then don't stress out about not having single-pointed concentration. Because if there are causes and conditions for it, then the result's not going to come. So don't stress saying, oh, my concentration is so terrible, it's so terrible. Well, it's because you don't have the conditions around you yet to develop that kind of concentration. You get what I'm saying? Okay, so the first condition is a favorable place. Okay, so the middle of New York with your windows open on Fifth Avenue, okay, with the telephone ringing and your internet connection playing your favorite thing and your iPod plugged in, is not listed among the most favorable places. Okay? So favorable places. First of all, a place that's calm and clean. Yeah? If you're in a place where there's a lot of energy and rushing around and that kind of vibration, that's going to affect your mind. You're not going to be able to stabilize your mind in a concentrated way. You want a clean place because a clean place affects your mind in a positive way. You know, it makes your mind more peaceful. If you're in a place like with a lot of rubbish and stuff around, that's going to affect your mind. You know, if you try and go meditate in the middle of your office with your computer there and all your correspondence, you think you can meditate well? No? Or in your house with, you know, all the kids' toys spread all over the carpeting and a bunch of dirty dishes in the sink? No. Okay, so we need a calm and clean place. Then we need a place where we have easy access to food and water and the necessities of life, medicine, things like that. Okay. Sometimes people get very idealistic. I'm going to go up in the Himalayas and meditate. I'm not sure how they're thinking to get food and fresh water. Maybe they're planning on packing their microwave up there. But I don't think that's going to work too well. Okay, so you want easy access to food and water. So also you don't have to spend much time worrying about how to get things or running around trying to get things that you need to sustain your practice. The third quality of a favorable place is that it's been used by meditators, previous meditators. So this one isn't always possible here in the West, but at least a place that has some kind of calm and still and sacred feeling. In Asia, there's many places where previous meditators have meditated, and if you go there, it becomes easier to concentrate, so it's kind of less the place. And your mind remembers them sitting there, and so automatically tries to be like them. Okay. So here in the West, we're in the process of setting up centers and monasteries and temples where we are blessing the environment and bringing that in. You can feel that here at GFF now. You've been here, 12 years. So you're blessing this place. It has a completely different feel. Okay, next quality of a favorable place is that it's free from danger and disease. So you don't want to be in a place with lots of wild animals or wild people. You know. When I moved to the Abbey, you know, we're in the middle of nowhere, and I was living there alone, and people said, aren't you afraid of being in the forest? And actually, I felt much safer there than I did in the middle of the city. But anyway, a place where, you know, there's no chance of you getting diseases and illnesses and injuries and danger where your mind's preoccupied with your own safety. Okay, so safe place. And then the next quality is that you're near other meditators, and either teachers that you can rely on or other people who are doing a similar practice to yours, who have some experience. And the reason for this is that we need, things come up when you're meditating, and you need to have resources and people around you who can help. Because, sometimes we go into retreat all naive, oh yes, it's going to be a bliss, But then you start remembering things from the past, and meanwhile you've forgotten what the antidotes for anger and emotional upset are, So you need to have a teacher, an experienced meditator around you who can remind you of the antidotes or teach those antidotes to you. Or, if you're having difficulty with laxity and falling asleep, who could give you tips on what to do or remind you of the ones that you know. Okay? Or you need resource books. Sometimes all sorts of things can come up when you're doing a very strict retreat. So you need access to people who can assist you. So those are the conditions for a favorable place, which is, the favorable place is the first of the conditions that we need. Okay? Then the second condition is a clear understanding of how to do the practice. Okay? So, if you're doing a retreat to develop serenity, you need to know exactly how to do the practice. How do you develop mindfulness? How do you develop introspection or clear comprehension? What is your object of meditation? What to do if certain obstacles come? You need to have a clear understanding of this. If you're doing another kind of retreat, you need to know what kind of retreat you're doing. If you're doing retreat in general, are you doing the retreat on the deity? Are you doing long rim retreat? Are you doing serenity retreat? What are you doing? And you need to know very clearly. You can't just kind of walk in and say, I'm doing retreat. What am I supposed to do? So doing retreat really takes some preparation, and you need to learn the practice that you're doing before you go into the retreat situation. Of course, you'll study the practice more in depth at the retreat and get some experience through your own meditation, but you need to understand the general instructions clearly before you start. Starting a retreat isn't the time to kind of go, what am I supposed to do? Okay? So you really start preparing for a retreat a long time before you begin and have a very clear understanding of what you're doing and how you're doing it. And so if you don't have that, then it's much better to wait and set, and have instructions from the teacher about what to do and how to do that retreat and get some familiarity with it before you go into the situation. Because if you accumulate the causes, the conditions for a good retreat, then, that will follow. Okay. A lot of times, if it's your first time doing retreat, Lama Yeshe used to always recommend that we do a group retreat. If you have the difficulty maintaining the discipline of a regular daily practice, then you're probably going to have difficulty maintaining the discipline of a retreat if you're doing a retreat alone. If you do retreat with a group, then the whole group has the schedule and you're sitting at certain times, and so because everybody's doing that, you automatically do it. So this also happens to be the benefit of living at a monastery or temple, because everybody's, I can't get up at 4:30 in the morning. Well, you will if everybody else is. And I can't sit for that long. Well, you will if everybody else is. So, doing it with a group is very That's regarding the retreat in general. Okay, another condition is that you are free from gross desires. That's a difficult one, isn't it? Okay, why is that? Why do you have to be free from gross desires? Because otherwise you sit down on your meditation cushion and what are you doing? You know, you're pulling out your mental sky mall booklet. You know, when you're flying, they have the sky mall. So you have your mental sky mall booklet, you know, and you're paging through your little booklet of everything you want to buy as soon as you finish retreat. Mm-hmm. Well, it's going to be a little bit difficult developing concentration. You know. And where does your internal sky mall magazine come from? It comes from having a lot of gross desires. Okay. So you have to really, you know, before you go into retreat, start working with that mind that says, I want X, Y, and Z. Or the way we usually phrase it is, I need X, Y, and Z. You know, we have a difficult time discriminating between what we want and what we need. So we just say we need it all. You know, it makes it easy, doesn't it? And it sounds much better than saying I want, because wanting sounds like we're maybe a little bit self-centered or attached, and we don't want to really feel that way to other people. So I really need another car, and I need, you know, my 20th pair of shoes, and I need, you know, to upgrade this, and I need that. As if we're going to collapse from starvation or something if we don't get it. Okay. So the American's consumer mind is not a good condition for doing retreat. Okay. Or maybe I should also say the Mexican consumer mind. But I don't know. Maybe I shouldn't be too, you know, restricted to one country. Everybody has that. Okay? So to have few gross desires. And then the next condition is to be easily content. Because, again, if you're doing strict retreat, maybe people will be bringing you food. If you're not easily content, then, you know, you're going to say, I don't like that. Why don't they bring this? Mm-hmm. Or I don't like this meditation. I want that. I don't like that Buddha statue, you know, that somebody brought me. I want another one. Okay? So, you know, it can happen in many ways. So, you know, we want few gross desires and we want to be easily content. So if we're easily content, then whatever we have is good enough. And I think that, you know, regardless of whether we do a strict retreat or not, developing these qualities is very good for our Dharma practice in general. Okay. So really practicing. Here's a new mantra for you. What I have is good enough. Okay. And it has a few mantras that are related. What I have is good enough. What I do is good enough. Who I am is good enough. Try that one. Okay? It's a new one for us, isn't it? Because we are constantly taught to be dissatisfied. That's how our country survives and our economy survives, is based on dissatisfaction. That you need more and you need better. Yeah? So not only materially needing more and better, but, you know, we compare ourselves to other people and we think we need to do more and better. Here's somebody else who knows more than me, so, I better get more knowledge. Or who has a higher job position than me, so I better, you know, compete with them and get to be like them. Here's somebody who works harder. I better work more overtime. Okay? So we feel so discontent even with what we do. You know, I don't do enough. happens. So then we squeeze ourselves and stress ourselves out. Or we think that we aren't good enough. Everybody else has Buddha nature, only me. It doesn't. That's what we all think, isn't it? Oh, look, everybody here, they're so quiet meditating. So, you know, all these things of discontent with what we have, what we do, who we are, that acts as a big hindrance to developing concentration. Because, you know, we're always going to be thinking about that in our mind. I should meditate more. I should meditate longer sessions, even though, you know, they say to have shorter sessions. I should concentrate more. Grit our teeth and we clench our fists and we're going to go into battle with those delusions. You know, that doesn't work. It just doesn't work. So we have to have a certain degree of self-acceptance and comfort level with ourselves. And stop comparing ourselves to other people. I mean, really, that's, I think, one of the worst things we do, is how we compare ourselves to other people. Because when we do, then, you know, if we do it in a constructive way, then, and we see that somebody's better than us, we compare ourselves in a constructive way, and we see somebody's better in a certain way, then we can say, oh, if they can do it, then I can do it. So that's okay. That way of comparing ourselves to others is okay. But usually what happens is we compare ourselves to others, and if somebody's better than us, then we get jealous. Yeah. Jealousy, you know, forget about concentrating when you're jealous. And then that breeds low self-esteem, and then that breeds depression, and, you know, that makes it difficult to meditate. Or if we compare ourselves to somebody else and we're better, then, you know, we get arrogant and conceited. And then sometimes that leads to becoming complacent and apathetic and negligent. So that's not so good. Or we compare ourselves with others and we feel equal, and then we compete. You know, I'm going to sit 1 minute more in meditation. Even though my legs are killing me and I can't concentrate with beings, you know? So that kind of competition doesn't work very well in regular life or in our spiritual practice. Okay, so some degree of contentment. So really try that. You know, what I have is good enough. So whatever you have, really think it's good enough. It works. It's good enough. What I do is good enough. In the future, maybe I can improve. But at least for right now, you know, we can't change the present, so might as well like it. In the future, I can gradually improve. Who I am is good enough. We don't have to be like everybody else. We all have our own individual unique talents and qualities. And so to try and, you know, to think that we have to have the qualities and talents of other people is really unrealistic. You know, it's much better to see what specific talents and qualities we have and use those rather than thinking that we have to be, you know, God's gift to the world. Okay, so lots of self-acceptance and contentment. And the next condition is to be free from involvement with worldly activities. Yeah, so this one is difficult now that there's emails and telephones and things like that. And you're trying to do retreat, and then it's like, well, I gotta check my email. I gotta check the message machine. And so this is why it's very good to go to another place where you don't live to do retreat, yeah, where you don't have email, know, you might use your computer for studying, but you don't have email access. You don't have a telephone. You know, there are no cell phones allowed. You know, but so that you're not involved in lots of worldly activities. Because if you're trying to make plans for future activities, if you're trying to do business during the middle of a retreat, if you're trying to arrange, you know, your parents' 35th wedding anniversary, if, you know, whatever it is, then you know, you're going to be back and forth and doing things. And so that doesn't work too well with retreat. Okay, so very little involvement in worldly activities. Clearly, because if you're involved in those activities, you won't have time to sit. Or when you're sitting, you're going to be thinking about what you're doing, you know, in the break time. Okay, and then the last one is pure ethical conduct. So whatever level of precepts you have, to keep that level of precepts. A retreat situation is a very good time to work on your ethical conduct and to study your precepts. Okay? Whether you have Pratimoksha precepts, Bodhisattva precepts, Tantra precepts, they're very good to study in the break time and then really refine your ethical conduct. And the reason for this is when we keep good ethical conduct, our mind is very relaxed. When we don't keep ethical conduct, then our mind has a lot of regret, it has a lot of guilt, it has a lot of turmoil, it has fear because we've done something we shouldn't and other people are going to find out about it. Okay? So, you know, whereas if we really make an effort to have good ethical conduct, then our mind just can be very peaceful. There's no interruption from regret or guilt or fear, these kinds of things, uncertainty. Okay? So those are the six conditions. I'll just read them over, so make sure you have six here. Okay, a favorable place, a clear understanding coming to the practice, free from gross desires, okay, then being easily satisfied and content, and then free from involvement with worldly activities, and pure ethical conduct. Okay, so those six. And so this is especially for doing a retreat to gain serenity. For general retreats, you may not necessarily have every single one of these, but as much as possible to have all of these, that much better your retreat's going to be. Because you have a good situation, you won't have to be battling external hindrances or the internal hindrance of all your ignorance and regret and those kinds. Then, in terms of meditation posture, if you can sit in the Vajra position, that's the best. Some people call the Vajra position the lotus position. I'm not quite sure why, but I think the name is the Vajra position. And so your legs are crossed, the left foot is on the right thigh, and then the right thigh is put on, the right foot is put on the left thigh. Okay, so your left foot is in closer to you, and then the right foot. If you can't sit like that, then you can put one of the legs down, put your right leg down, and just keep your left leg up. If you can't sit like that, then you can sit in what we call the Tara position, with your left leg closer in and your right leg in front of that, not stretched out like Tara, but like you're sitting, okay? Or if you can sit like that, and in the Tara position, both your legs are flat on the ground, so that's quite comfortable. If you can sit like that, then cross-legged. Yeah, if you need to put cushions under your knees, that's okay. You might have to experiment a little bit with cushions under your rear, you know, to get the right height, to get the right shape, to get the right softness or hardness. But one little bit of advice is, after a certain while, give up trying to find the perfect Because it's not an issue of the cushion, it's the issue of our body that is out of shape and our body that has restless energy. Okay. Then your back is straight. Right? The hands are the right on the left, palms up, thumbs are together, forming a triangle. And this is in your lap, okay, against your body. And then your shoulders are level, not like this. Okay, but level, am I level? and then your arms, can see there's a little bit of space here between the body and the arms. So you don't want it like that, chicken wings. but you don't want it like this either, like fish, whatever. Okay, but just kind of relaxed to it. Yeah. Then your head is level, or you might just tuck your chin in just a tinge, okay? Don't lift your chin up like this. I notice a lot of people, you know, who have bifocals, yeah, your chin's kind of up like this. That's why I don't wear my glasses all the time. Adjusting how to put my head, you know? Be careful of your microphone when you're meditating also. Okay, so your head kind of level and straight, not like this or this. Your nose is kind of even with your navel. Don't droop your head because it'll keep on drooping. Then your mouth is closed, yeah, but your teeth are not clenched. Your mouth should be relaxed. If you have allergies or a cold, then breathe through your mouth. It's okay. Yeah. It's not the best situation for doing breathing meditation, but it's better than not breathing. Okay. Oh, I remember some of you may have been at those retreats at Cloud Mountain in June, which is the height of the allergy season, and I was teaching breathing meditation. Do you remember that one retreat? I couldn't breathe at all. You know, I was just like with one tissue after the other. So, you know, do the best you can. What points did I miss about that? Okay, legs, hands, shoulders, back, head, mouth, eyes. Okay? So your eyes, it's good if you can keep them a little bit open. You're not really looking at anything. They're just a wee bit open, and they're down, you know, if you're going to put them anywhere, they say at the tip of your nose, but that can give you a headache. That's not so comfortable. So down here, just in front of you, but you're not looking at anything. The reason for keeping your eyes a little bit open is because that way some light comes in, and it prevents you from getting drowsy, and also that helps you become familiar with doing meditation while your senses are still functioning. Now, of course, you know, it's preferable to meditate in a quiet place, but you're never going to find a perfectly quiet place. So we have to also learn to deal with noise and to just, you know, be able to recognize it and not pay too much attention to it. You know, getting distracted by it. The typical thing is for beginners, you know, you sit down to meditate and then you hear some noise. Okay. Why is refrigerator going on? It knows I'm meditating. I can't stand this noise. Get rid of this refrigerator. The person next to me in the meditation hall is breathing so loud. Don't they know that you're not supposed to make noise when you breathe? Oh, why don't they be quiet? And so-and-so, when they're clicking their mala, when you're doing a mantra retreat. And then they take the mala and put put it down on the table. Bang! And you're furious. Who does that guy think he is, clicking his mala when I'm trying to develop concentration? She's been teaching about cherishing others more than yourself. Why doesn't he cherish me more than his mala? You know, we get so upset. Or the other great good one, you know, the person turns the pages of their side. Yeah? Yes, that one gets one of those. We get so mad, furious. So if you're getting mad because of some noise, remember that the problem is not the noise, the problem is your mind. Okay? You know, I think this is, isn't there some Zen story? Something about, is the flag moving or is the air moving? And the answer was, it's the mind that's moving? Well, this is it, you know. It's not somebody else that's making noise, it's my mind that's making noise. Because all my irritation and anger at that person, that's my own internal noise, my own internal conversation, isn't it? So what I found to be the best way to deal with these kinds of things is to completely welcome the person. You know, you hear a baby crying, I'm so glad that baby's born. May that baby grow up to be healthy and happy and a Dharma practitioner. You hear somebody clicking their mala. Wow, isn't it wonderful that they're doing retreat and saying mantra? You hear somebody turning pages in the sadhana. Wow, it's great that they've come here to do retreat. You hear a car go by. This isn't the ideal situation for development. You know, for serenity retreat. But in your daily practice, you hear the car go by. May that person be well and happy. Maybe they be safe in their car. The refrigerator goes on. How kind of, you know, it's my refrigerator. Who am I blaming other people for? But how kind of somebody to make a refrigerator, even though it makes noise. Okay. So I found the best thing to prevent getting angry at the noise is just to completely welcome it. That doesn't mean we pay attention to it, but it stops the anger, and the anger soon becomes a much bigger problem than the noise. Because when you get up, when you're angry, you get up from your meditation session, and you know, oh, you're ready to go give the guy sitting in back of you the dirtiest look. You know, because they squirm too much in their meditation. We have lots of laughs about this at the Abbey. You know, you do group retreat, and so somebody comes in. We had such a big laugh about this. He was late for a session, and so he was wearing one of these nylon jackets, you know, that makes so much noise. And he was, you know, trying to take it off quietly. Yeah, after the session started, we didn't have a chance. We were there on that retreat. And so then you have the person who's undoing the zipper, you know, one little thing at a time. Because they don't want to make any noise, like, whoop. So they just do it. Yeah, and you just wish they would show the jacket twice. Yeah, so the good thing is just, you know, be able to laugh at these kinds of things, you know, instead of getting upset. And know that the other person's probably much more embarrassed. Okay. And similarly, you know, with the person behind you that squirms, you know, or the middle-aged woman who's taking off her jacket, taking off, have some compassion. Okay. And, you know, and remember our motivation. Okay?
Okay, another important factor in our meditation is having the correct motivation. And I spoke a little bit about this last time. Okay? But really, the importance of at the beginning of the session setting a strong motivation, and specifically a motivation of bodhicitta. So I leave one before teachings every time, but when you're on your own, you can invent your own bodhicitta meditation. Not invent, like make it up out of nowhere, but you can, you know, go about it in different ways. Maybe sometimes you think more about precious human life, or sometimes you think about death and impermanence, or sometimes you think about cyclic existence, you know, and or sometimes you do the bodhicitta meditations, but whatever it is, you lead yourself to the conclusion that I'm doing this in order to become a Buddha for the benefit of sentient beings. Okay. And the stronger your motivation is at the beginning of the session, the better your session is going to go. You know, because we all know that when we're highly motivated for something, we enjoy it more, it goes easier, we do it better. Okay? So really take some time with your motivation. In terms of the hindrances, you know, none of them mention pain. Yeah? Either that, you know, either set of five hindrances, none of them mention pain. So let me talk a little bit about pain. Yeah? First of all, I think, at least what I discovered with myself, is at the beginning I had so much restless physical energy. Because we're not used to sitting still, are we? We are always, you know, gotta get up and go and do something. So our body doesn't know how to sit still, and our mind doesn't know how to sit still. So it takes some time just getting yourself to be able to sit still. And sometimes the restless energy will come out as pain. You know, I remember when I did Vaidarshatha retreat after knowing the Dharma about a year, my right leg, I was stretching it and bending it and this and that and the other thing, because it was always hurting. But after a while, I discovered it wasn't so much the pain as it was just restless physical energy. So learning to sit there, and if you feel that restless physical energy, just sit there. You don't need to move. And just observe that energy and observe how your mind reacts to it. How the mind sometimes says, I can't sit here one split second longer. Yeah, I have to get up. I have to move. I have to do something. Do you have that come up sometimes? You know, it's like you feel like everything is just so tense and you can't sit there one day, one second longer. And you just sit there and watch that feeling. Okay? Observe that feeling. You don't have to be that feeling. You can step back and observe that feeling. What does that feel like? Where in my body is that restless feeling located? Or is it my mind that's telling a story, a restless story? What is it? So do some investigation there. Okay? Another good thing for restless energy, you know, for the mind that says, I have to get up and answer that phone call, or I have to get up and do this and that, okay? Is when you first sit down for your session, ask yourself, you know, you have however long you're going to meditate, and you say, is there anything earth-shatteringly important that I have to do for the X number of minutes? Okay? And if there is, you know, if somebody's going to die, take them to the hospital before you do your meditation session. But if There's nothing of earth-shattering importance that at the beginning of a session you've decided there's nothing else that is more important that you need to be doing at this time. So then you sit there, you know? And if the thought comes up of, oh, I've really got to do this, then you say, well, I thought about it beforehand and I decided that there was nothing that couldn't wait until the end of the session. And so then you put that down. Now, for pain itself, there's two elements of pain. There's the physical pain, and then there's what the mind does with the pain. The physical pain is just a tactile sensation. So all it is a tactile sensation. What's very interesting to observe is how the mind reacts to that tactile. My knee hurts. If I don't move my knee, you know, the whole cartilage is going to get torn apart and I'm going to need a knee replacement surgery and I can't afford that right now because I don't have enough insurance. But why did I take this job? It doesn't give me good enough insurance anyway. You know? And then you're off on a distraction, aren't you? But it's just a physical pain. It's a physical sensation. Are you really going to be crippled forever if you don't move your knee? Highly unlikely. So if something is excruciatingly painful, adjust your position. But don't adjust your position the first time the thought comes in your mind to do it. Because otherwise, that's just restless mind, isn't it? And if you can begin to see how the mind reacts to pain, and how, and it's interesting, because each of us, it might be a little bit different, but sometimes we feel a small pain, and then our mind gets so incredibly worried. You're sitting there meditating and your stomach gurgles and then you go, oh, what's happening? Maybe I have an ulcer. And we dream up all these incredible things. So just to watch that. Watch how the mind relates to sensations in the body. And try and differentiate what is the sensation, the physical sensation that is from your tactile, you know, consciousness, and what is your mind's reaction to that? Separate them out. And this is a very, very good thing to be able to do, not just for our meditation, but because we have bodies that are under the influence of karma and afflictions, our body is always going to hurt in one way or another, at one time or another, and developing some ability to observe the pain without getting in the middle of it and without letting our mind go on a whole big trip about how catastrophic that pain is. You know, developing that ability is very, very helpful for us. You know, separate out what's the mind and what's the body. Because when our mind starts to spin, it hardly needs anything. There's some little funny sensation in the tip of our finger and, you know, all of a sudden we're self-diagnosing ourselves with some horrible illness and getting afraid when there's no need at all to do that. Okay, so that's one thing, separate the two. Then another thing is, sometimes when you're watching the physical sensation, try and figure out exactly where the sensation is. And it's very interesting because when you try and do that, try and draw a little mental line around where that pain is, it's very interesting. It moves and it changes. And you become a little bit uncertain exactly what the sensation is that you were looking for. It's very interesting to do that. Okay. Or another thing, which I find very helpful, because this leads into some reflection on emptiness, is why do I call this pain? If I say that I'm experiencing pain, how do I know I'm experiencing pain? Why do I call this sensation pain? And I don't mean to get, you get involved in some big mental thing up here, you know. But you're focused on the sensation. And why, what is painful about this sensation? What exactly is the pain? Very interesting. So that's a good thing to do. The taking and giving meditation. May everybody who has aching knees and aching back, may I take all their suffering and the karma that produces that away from them, you know, and I bring it in and blow out my own self-centered thought and give and radiate out, you know, hip replacements. Aspirin, no, radiate out healthy bodies, getting closer, you know. But, still loving kindness to the others. That's another good way to do it. So, this is the second set of five hindrances. And so there's five hindrances, and then there's eight remedies or eight antidotes to them. Okay, so the first hindrance is our old friend. Starts with an L. We're thinking of all sorts of good hindrances.
Yeah.
Let's start with an L. Laziness. That's it. Okay. First thing is laziness. The second one is forgetting the object of meditation. The third one is laxity and excitement combined together. They're listed as one, now there's two. Okay. The fourth one is not applying the antidote to lethargy and excitement when you should. And the fifth one is applying the antidote or over-applying the antidote when you no longer have that hindrance. Okay, so those are the five hindrances. So they're a bit different than that first set. Okay. Then there's eight antidotes. The first four antidotes apply to laziness. Okay? So the first antidote is faith, then aspiration, then effort, and then pliancy. I'm just listing these right now. I'll go back and describe them. Then for the second one, forgetting the object, then the antidote for that is mindfulness. For the third one, laxity and excitement, the antidote is alertness or introspective awareness. For the fourth one of not applying the antidote when you need to, the antidote to that is applying the antidote. And the antidote to over-applying the antidote is equanimity. Okay. So let's go back to the beginning. We won't get through all five of these. We just have a couple of minutes. So the first one of laziness. So here we come back to the three kinds of laziness we talked about. Do you remember them? First one? Sleeping, procrastination. Second one? Busyness, doing useless things. Okay. Third one, discouragement. Yeah. Okay, so those three. So if we have any of those three, it's going to be difficult to develop concentration practice, isn't it? Because either we won't get to the cushion, because we're too busy doing something else or procrastinating, or we get to the cushion and we tell ourselves we can't do it, so we get up. Okay, so the way faith works with that is faith doesn't mean like this kind of blind faith or anything. Here what faith means is faith in meditative stabilization, faith in concentration. Yeah, faith that it's possible to develop that quality. Okay? And so here what you do is you reflect on the advantages of developing concentration and the disadvantages of not developing concentration. Okay? And so when you reflect on those, then you feel, oh, wow, you know, this is something I want to do. So this is more the, there's three kinds of faith. This is the admiring kind of faith. So you admire concentration by seeing its advantages and the disadvantages of not having it. Okay, so disadvantages of not having concentration. You know, very difficult to develop any good qualities because you can't stay focused. Yeah, so, you know, it becomes a hindrance for developing good qualities in general. It becomes a hindrance for, you know, realizing emptiness or developing bodhicitta. And things like that. The benefits of developing concentration? Well, then, you know, it's the in the gate for all these good qualities. Because when you can stay focused on something, then you can train your mind in that good quality. So whatever meditation you decide to do, if you can concentrate, then that meditation, you know, an understanding of that meditation will come to you so much easier because you can stay on the topic. When you're doing longer meditation or deity meditation or whatever, you'll be able to stay on that, so some understanding will come much easier. Okay. And then, you know, concentration is also very, very good for your health, because to be able to concentrate, you know, means overcoming all these different hindrances that we talked about. And these hindrances are often things that interfere with our health, aren't they? Yeah? You have a lot of lethargy, it's not healthy, a lot of anxiety or restlessness or, you know, worry or regret or ill will. These things are not so good for your health. So developing concentration is very good for your physical health. And it's also good for your mental health, because when we're able to attain levels of samadhi, then the afflictions are suppressed. So the very gross level of afflictions, they aren't eliminated completely, but they're suppressed. So the jealousy and the resentment and the, you know, the rebelliousness and the negligence and the conceit and all these things, they don't manifest in the mind in a very gross, interfering way when you have high stages of concentration. So the mind becomes very, very peaceful as well. So, you know, if we really reflect on these benefits of developing concentration, then we have some interest in it, and our mind is eager, and that leads to the next one, which is aspiration. Okay? So when we have the interest that comes from having faith and seeing the advantages and disadvantages, then we have the aspiration to develop concentration. When we have the aspiration to do something, then we make effort to do it. And the effort isn't torturous effort, it's joyous effort because we aspire and we're interested in it. And then the actual antidote to the laziness is pliancy, which is a very flexible state of body and mind, where you can, it's a mental factor, where you can put your attention on an object, and your mind is very flexible, and so it can stay there and it leads to a very deep experiences of contentment and of bliss. So that's the actual antidote to the laziness. So, that's the first of the hindrances. We'll continue with the next ones next week. In the meantime, hopefully there's something in here you can use in your daily practice. So maybe, you know, especially work on this thing about developing contentment. What I have is good enough. What I do is good enough. Who I am is good enough. Because, you know, if you can have that, then, you know, kind of overcoming sloth and torpor and busyness and discouragement, all of that comes much easier.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all our inner hindrances, grant such inspiration, I pray. May the light of the venerable spiritual masters be stable, and their divine actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Lotus teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the free world always increase. Dhanuratna mandalakta meyatayami. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the enlightened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind not yet born arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain paradise, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful tempting Gyatso Chenrezi, may you stay until samsara ends.
May the
deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders who spread the view of dependent arising and non-violent actions in the 10 directions, and especially extra bhakti in the West Globe.